Welcome to CFO Insights, the leading podcast for finance professionals in disruptive tech, brought to you by the startup CFO community. I'm Guy Hutchinson, I'm the host of the podcast as well as being a tech CFO. In this episode, we're going to talk to Paul Barnhurst, the FP&A guy and a thought leader in training and content that helps FP&A and finance leaders drive better business decisions. We dive into the critical what's of FP&A, discuss the upside of seeking out those all-important leading indicators, and you might be surprised why FP&A leads and CFOs alike need to adjust their communications to bring the bottom line right to the front. Introducing our new podcast sponsor, Vertice, founded in the UK by serial entrepreneurs and brothers Eldar and Roy Tuvey. Vertice is a technology company designed to help startups and scale-ups manage their SaaS and cloud spend. To find out how to streamline your renewals and get visibility on your tech stack, and most importantly, save up to 25% on your SaaS and cloud spend, visit vertice.one and click Start Saving. And best of all, our listeners qualify for a 10% discount off the cloud and SaaS bundle. Just enter CFO Insights Podcast in the Where Did You Hear About Us field. Paul, welcome onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Guy. I'm super excited to be here.
That's fantastic. Look, we were having a chat maybe 2 weeks ago, and it was really interesting to hear about the kind of programs that you're building as part of the FP&A guy, and how much demand there is really for people in growth businesses like tech businesses, but also people in corporate life really seeking to sort of learn and expand their skill set as financial analysts. And we talked a little bit about the world where FP&A and being a tech CFO collide as one, and realized that was a great topic for a podcast.
Yeah, I think so. I'm excited to discuss that today with you.
Yeah, it should be good. I mean, it was always one of my favorite topics. I mean, I was a tech CFO for the best part of 15 years, and I realized that there were two scenarios, really. One was you'd got in really early, maybe after like a Series A or something, and it was you doing this, like you were CFO, but also like the chief analyst. And that meant you had to roll up your sleeves and really understand some of the metrics and some of the challenges understanding the business. And then there was another scenario where you'd come in a bit later and you would essentially build out that team. But under both guises, you're essentially responsible for how you use those metrics to help to guide the business and how you build things like financial plans. And it's a very complicated area. It's definitely one that needs a bit of educational support. And so, Paul, you know, it'd be really interesting just to hear about your background and how you started to build the venture you have now.
Yeah, so I'd love to share a little bit about that. So, you know, after grad school, I started my career in a different field, went to grad school. After grad school, I started working in finance, with the majority of that time being FP&A. This was around late 2008. And I worked in FP&A full-time until early mid 2022. And then I started my own business, which I've been doing for about 2 years. I got into it through a friend who I had reached out to looking for a job. He asked me to write an article. That led to writing a few more, led to me being more active on LinkedIn, some speaking engagements, and then just over time, multiple different things came together where I thought I could turn this into a business. After my wife, you know, picked herself up after me suggesting it, like, wait, what are you talking about? She got on board and started the business in March of 2022. You know, do a few things within the business. So I provide content nearly daily on LinkedIn around Excel, around FP&A, around FP&A software. In addition to that, I have a couple podcasts, one called FP&A Tomorrow, that's all about what great FP&A looks like today, what it should look like in the future. I have another one where I interview some of the best guests in the world about financial modeling and help provide, you know, practical advice and stories to help people be better modelers. Then I have training. I have a virtual course, a best practice FP&A course that we teach, where we do 4 modules around analysis, budgeting and forecasting, business partnering, and data storytelling, and then visualization as well. I have some other courses on Excel and various different subjects. And then I also do research on software tools. I'm just getting ready to release my 3rd generation market guide that shares a lot of the latest and newest planning tools in the marketplace. So I got my hands in quite a few things and keep quite busy in the FP&A space.
Yeah, Paul, that is amazing. That's a really broad field of coverage. And it feels like every sub-silo of FP&A is covered there somewhere. And it's really interesting, actually, that it seems like your kind of light bulb moment from your 12 years of doing FP&A work and starting to turn that into a framework that would help others really comes from having to sit down one day with a blank sheet of paper or blank doc and start to write about your discipline. It feels like that was the trigger for all the things you have now.
Yeah, it really was. And it was kind of funny because I was looking for a job. I reached out to a guy and I said, hey, I'll give you a Starbucks gift card if you'll give me 30 minutes of your time. And he's like, I don't want your gift card. I want you to write an article for my website. And I remember thinking, I suck at writing, but okay, I'll do that. And I did it. And then he's like, hey, if you write me another one, I'll give you $100. And I did a couple more for him. And that really was the beginning. And never in a million years did I think I'd end up where I'm at today, back when he asked me to write that article. And so it's been a kind of long journey in a path that I never envisioned, but I love where I'm at now.
Yeah. It's a very, very, very cool story, Paul. So Startup CFO, we're this community of 900 and something tech CFOs, like mainly in the UK, but more and more over time in Germany, Netherlands, Nordics, France, etc. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that, you know, would listen to our podcast regularly would be thinking, well, that's a really huge set of skills to excel at FP&A. And I can see why, you know, large corporates would invest and have a lot of training and get their people up to speed. But I'm like under a lot of time pressure because I'm in a startup or a scale up. And so how do you think about condensing some of your key learnings so that CFOs could just grab a hold of that and do something with it?
Yeah. So I think that's where I try to share a lot of things on LinkedIn, do podcasts, different events so people can listen to the summary if they want. They can listen to an episode. They can read something on LinkedIn for a couple minutes and get some general ideas. I think when you're busy, it's really boiling it down to what's important. And I think for me, FP&A, the most important thing is learning to be a great commercially strategic-driven business partner that can help inform and guide the business to make smart decisions. That's really the message, whether you're CFO, head of FP&A, or really even an analyst. But across FP&A, that's the message I try to deliver again and again.
Is that so that piece where you're looking for these much more strategic people that can inform and essentially sort of, you know, persuade and steer the business in some capacity. That's a mixture of like hard skills. So like those really technical skills to build like a three-statement model or something like this, or to analyze some numbers and see if an A-B test worked or something like that. But combining those sort of typically spreadsheet-centric skills with things that are much more about storytelling, how to frame a position, how to engage with business people that are not as comfortable with the numbers as you might be.
Yes, it really is. I mean, right, FP&A starts with some table stake skills. You have to be able to analyze data. You're going to need to work in a spreadsheet, more than likely Excel. If you're going to be a small company, you need to understand a three-statement model, full stop. You need to be able to build one for a smaller company. And that's why I'm a huge fan of FMI. I've partnered with them on my podcast, as they do a certification to validate that people have three-statement modeling skills. Something I did recently was took that test. So I think those are some of the areas it starts with, those basics. But then beyond that, it really gets into what we'll call the soft skills, or I like to call the human skills. How do you influence the business? How do you show curiosity and get to know the operations and have that commercially driven mindset so you can ensure the business is making smart decisions? They're staying on task for the budget, versus being someone that just sits behind their desk. One of the favorite quotes I've had in all my podcast times comes from Jim Cook, who he said two things. He's like, when you start the job, start with a listening tour. And I think that's great advice for CFOs, for FP&A in general. And the second is, remember, your product is not the spreadsheet. Your product are the insights and decisions that are driven from the spreadsheet. I think it's important to keep those things in mind because it's easy to get lost in the numbers. I've done it many times.
Yeah. I think we've all been kind of victims of that type of thinking where the more time you spend with the numbers, the more you believe that's really about what they seem to be telling you. But actually, when you convey that in an exec meeting or a trading meeting or a board meeting, actually, that's not what the audience are hearing. They're looking to listen to a story being conveyed. And that story might be backed up by the numbers, but it certainly isn't all about the numbers.
Exactly. I mean, the story is about so much more than the numbers. It's helping bring those numbers to life. Why are they important? What does it mean? What do we do now because of those numbers, right? It's much more than just, hey, here's a bunch of numbers. You guys go ahead and analyze them and make your decisions. I think if that's all you're doing, then you're doing your company a disservice.
Yeah. And your framework that you've developed to sort of help to remind and prompt people around about that type of thinking. This is a series of what statements, right? That's how you try to steer people towards that more influential type of thinking.
Yeah, there's a few frameworks we use, but one we love to use, particularly with variance commentary, right, that we do each month. And it was created in the 70s, and I cannot remember the guy's name right now. You're right, almost every good idea was created by somebody else. We just all try to use them. And that's true with this framework. And so the idea is what? It starts with what, right? When you're doing variance commentary, you need to tell the business what happened. Well, you know, we were $500,000 better in revenue, but that alone doesn't tell the business anything. No decisions can be made on that. So you go from what to so what. So why is that what important? Why are you telling me this? What's the reasoning behind that? And then it really goes to what's most important is the now what. Okay, so you've told me why it's important, but what do we do about it? What's the next steps? FP&A should be able to offer advice. And I'll give an example. You know, these are calculations I've run many times. Is, all right, we missed on our revenue for the month. So why did that happen? Well, it happened because we didn't hire the people we planned to hire. It was a slower ramp. Okay, so what do we do now? We could hire more people. We could sell more by leaning into marketing, and you can come up with a couple different options. Each of those may have different costs and different things associated with it. But now the business has something that they can actionably look at and think, should we do something versus just saying, oh, okay, we missed the revenue. Well, what does that mean? And that's really where the framework comes in, is helping guide that so that you can have those intelligent discussions on what to do next.
And that framework is taking the FP&A people or the CFO, that's taking them nearer the action, being the one that is leading to certain decisions being made in the business, rather than just the one that's sending in sort of commentary and that disappears into a black hole, which can happen in some businesses.
We've all been there, the black hole. I mean, one of the greatest compliments I ever received, and I think this really kind of sums up what we want to try to achieve, and definitely haven't always achieved it, but I had a general manager who one day said to me, he goes, Paul, you help shape the P&L. And what he meant by that is I was influencing the results in a positive way. And if we're being good business partners, good CFOs, doing FP&A and doing our work right, we should be having a positive influence on the bottom line.
Yeah, that piece where, as a finance leader, you can look at, say, the P&L 6 months later and realize that this important sort of decision that you made at some point in the past, that's paid off for you because you influenced something that happened, some change in how sort of capital was deployed in the business. And now some months later, you can see that that's lifting revenue or lowering OPEX or some mixture of these things.
Exactly. Yep. That it's always rewarding when you can look back and see the improvement in P&L and know you played a small part with the business as a partner.
That's really part of your mindset around how people ought to be deploying these skills, is that it's sort of starting with these strategic operational outcomes that you must be supporting or influencing those outcomes and taking pride in that. And then actually all of the number crunching and the producing of board packs and metric packs and commentary, that's really just like a subservient activity to those decisions. And then it's the pride in the decision support that you're seeking to try to focus the team on.
Correct. I'm really trying to focus the team on, you know, helping us achieve our overall overarching goals by managing the finances well and having those conversations that we need to have. Because it's easy, and we've all been guilty of it, to just get caught up in board deck and reporting and the numbers and forget why the numbers are important.
And when we chatted last week, we were saying that one of the things that you commonly see is that you might have a CFO who joins a business, and probably if it's a startup or a scale up, there's a lot of stuff to fix. And so they're sort of fixing the financial reporting and, you know, getting all the processes down correctly and getting the reporting so you've got, you know, the right definition for things like direct costs or cost of sales. And so because you're spending a lot of time on the financials, that you start to think a lot about the importance of that. But of course, it can often be the operational metrics, the things that might appear initially to be not a purely financial metric. Sometimes those are leading indicators.
100% agree. I mean, rarely is the financial indicator leading, right? Most financial indicators are lagging. And let's take an example with maybe a SaaS company, right? If your subscription revenue's down and you see that in your model, there should have been an operational metric that would have alerted you to that. You know, it could have been a decrease in people on the site. It could have been a decrease in usage on the product, a number of other things. If you're measuring those regularly, and those are those key performance indicators, the ones that really tie back to your core focus of the business, you'll be able to notice it and do something about it before you see it in the monthly or the quarterly results. And it's a little late to maybe save some of those customers or to get the revenue back on track as quick as you could have if you had been looking at those leading indicators to start with and making sure they were being monitored and talked about.
Yeah, it's a great example. Makes me think of, there was a company that I was in where with the kind of time lag to onboard a new customer and how you recognize revenue and things, the metric that you really needed to focus on if you were concerned about meeting your sales number was really conversion, because it was whether the sales guys were actually converting on their cohorts of leads that would tell you maybe 2 months later that you were going to hit your revenue number. And kind of, if you think about the ability to make any decision 2 months ahead of when you would have otherwise made it, I mean, that's huge. You've suddenly got much more responsive levers once you're thinking like that.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of put it in finance terms, is like time value of money, right? If you get to invest something 6 months earlier at a high interest rate, that's huge versus having to wait. And it's similar with information. The earlier you have it so you can invest in smart decisions, the more it compounds.
Yeah, absolutely. But then I guess the other danger is that as you start to dive into the operational metrics as a FP&A person, you can suddenly end up sat with a bunch of stakeholders. Maybe there's six people on the C-suite, so you do your six departmental meetings, and they all have metrics that they think are important. And suddenly you're producing a pack with like 100 metrics in it, and you are lost in the numbers, right? It's always a danger that some of the observation of the operational metrics is not quite as laser focused as it could be.
100% agree. And I know I've been guilty of that, of trying to track everything. And we probably all have. So, I mean, I still remember, you know, it was I think he was a general manager at the time. At one time, he was my CFO. But yeah, we got this list of metrics we wanted tracked. And it was super long. We just kind of started going. And before we knew it, we were listing everything. And the kind of the project mostly fell under its own weight, because we didn't really take the time to step back and think, let's start small, what's important? So the advice I generally give around metrics is, at a company level, there should be 3 or 5 key performance indicators. What's most important to make sure we're achieving our goals? If we manage these metrics and make sure they're above whatever the targets may be, then we should achieve our overall goals as a company, and they should be metrics we can influence. Then you can take that down, and different departments can have, you know, a set of KPIs. And that gives you kind of that ability to focus on what's important. After that, each department, if they want to track a bunch of metrics, or if you want to put them in dashboards, that's fine. There's times we need to look at different things and they can tell us stories. But there should always be a core set at a company and a department level that we can really focus on, that if we're doing well on those metrics, we're going to be on target.
Yeah. And that's about how FP&A teams support the senior leadership team, really, about the way in which you think about which metrics are metrics that you might actually present in the board, or you might use to decide about how you allocate the resources that you've got or how you hire people, but still allowing in the departmental silos them to monitor another whatever 20-30 metrics that might be useful at a more granular level but shouldn't be elevated up to the senior team in terms of how they make decisions.
Yeah, exactly. I think you've covered it there, is right. We need to make sure it's big picture. We don't want to give all the details to senior leadership.
Yes, super, super interesting, Paul. And one of the things that I think I've seen come up in Slack from our group, you know, quite a few times, is around sort of OKRs and the degree to which businesses become very OKR centric. And then possibly the FP&A team comes in actually a little bit after OKRs as sort of the cornerstone of things. Like, how do you think about organizations and sort of getting those objectives aligned?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're doing OKRs, I think that's a great method, right? There's a lot of different ones you can do, but make sure you involve FP&A and make sure the OKRs are reflected in your financial and your operational plans. At the end of the day, the more you can integrate your planning and break down those silos, the better chance you have of success. And I still remember when we implemented OKRs in one of our businesses, I was involved in every single meeting we had about OKRs and helped track that. And as we converted them to targets, we figured, okay, what would the financials look like if we accomplished that OKR? So, you know, we didn't necessarily put all of them in the plan because some of them, you know, were those big, hairy, audacious goals that weren't necessarily the plan that we thought we would achieve for corporate, but it's where we wanted to go. It was really where we were striving to be and help track those. And so I think that is a great way to do it, is just make sure that it's not a exercise of everybody in the business without finance, right? The support functions, finance, you know, being the one we're talking about here, they matter and need to be a part of that.
So it sounds like whether you're naturally drawn towards OKRs or not, if your organization is committed to them, then FP&A must be committed to engaging with that process so that you have a neat sort of connection between the two as things pan out.
I think so. I think finance needs to be involved. I mean, I think, right, it's just like in our personal life. Let's take it to a family. If you have goal, hey, we want to go on a big vacation this year. We want to do this. We want to do that. You're not going to make all these plans and just ignore the budget in your financials, right? That's a key part of what you're able to do. And so the two need to be tied together. And it's true with the business as well, that you always need to be looking at, you know, how that impacts the financials. Because if you don't have a profitable business, it doesn't matter how great your goals are or what you want to accomplish. If it can't be achieved financially, you got a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's the bottom line, right? You've got to get to a financial outcome in the end. You know, whether you're loss making, you're still fundraising, or you've got certain kind of financial outcomes that you want to achieve, be it break-even point or, you know, profitability or something. It's really, really key that you can break that back into what that means for financial outcome of the business. And one thing that I think you can really never escape, whether you're CFO or head of FP&A or a financial analyst, is this piece around partnering and the way in which sort of finance people who are worth their salt have a discipline in building these partnerships. And being somebody who can understand the world of marketing or understand operations or understand sales and partner with those departments. Have you interwoven that type of thing as part of your programs?
Yeah. So, you know, a couple things. First, before I jump into programs, I'm going to share a couple concepts. But from my podcast, you know, I've interviewed over 100 people, CFOs, analysts, head of FP&A, you know, FP&A managers, directors. And we always ask them, what's the advice you would give to a new FP&A person? And I think this really applies to all of us in finance. Number one is that comes up again and again is be curious, have a growth mindset, learn the business. And those really come up again and again. So we always try to teach that, the importance of learning the business. In my course, we focus on two things. The first is we teach about the importance of trust and some principles around how you can develop trust and what is required to have the trust of your business. And the second one, and it's one I learned the hard way, is we teach a principle called bluff. And when I first heard it, this manager goes, Paul, I want to teach you the bluff principle. I'm like, what are you talking about, bluff? And he looked at me and he goes, Paul, bottom line up front, stop giving me all the detail and get to the point. Put whatever's important first, then give me all the detail after. And it was clear in the way he said it. He goes, I won't read it. You provide too much detail, but feel free, knock yourself out, put as much as you want. And that was really a key moment for me in learning. I'd always been too detailed in my career and I'd been trying to work on it, but really hit home of the importance of just get to the point. I'm a busy person, which is typically the case of the leaders you're supporting. Tell them what they need to know. Tell them what those action items may be, what you're looking for. Then if you need to provide additional context, put it at the bottom and give them the choice on whether they need to dig into it or not.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Bluff, bottom line up front. I love that. As you were explaining how that process works and how to think about assuming that people are time poor and that you've got a relatively small amount of time to influence them, I was thinking about the difference between somebody who's trained as a sort of financial person and somebody who's trained as maybe a management consultant. And actually, the management consultants, they don't have such a big struggle with just getting to the point and getting to this is the thing I'm going to recommend. I think if you train as a financial analyst, it's very easy to be so in the weeds of all the detail you've had to go through, all the definitions you've refined to get to the numbers, that you think all of that is really important and that people have got time to understand all of that. But actually, once you've learned the business, they're almost certainly going to trust you that you've done all that stuff as you should have done. And that what really matters is how you can convey the story with those numbers and really persuade towards a certain outcome.
Yeah, it really is. You know, surprisingly enough, kind of funny, we've talked a lot about soft skills and numbers. And there was a graph I saw one time, and it listed the, you know, how much you need to have communication skills and math skills in careers. And the one to the furthest right, like up in the corner, was finance. And they had all these different careers listed. And I thought that was really interesting. You need the best combination of what we'll call soft skills, those communication skills combined with analytical skills to be successful. And so really, it's a combination. And I think too often we forget that. We can all learn to tell the story. Are we going to be a master storyteller and be able to present to the world? Probably not, right? We don't need to be, but we do need to be competent. We need to be good enough that people will listen and that we can influence them. And that just takes that commitment to becoming better at how you present stuff, the visualization side, the narrative, instead of getting caught up as we always do in the analysis. And I'll share one example that's really another one that stuck with me in my career on the importance of presenting. I had spent 6 months on this project, done a ton of analysis, got my regional CFO for the US signed off. I'd had my general manager signed off, the head of sales, the head of this organization. We were changing a commission process. You know, everybody had agreed with it, went to present to the CFO, thought it would be a slam dunk, our global CFO, start presenting to him. We're about 10 minutes into the meeting, maybe five. And he goes, this is a stupid idea. Why would we do this? And I didn't know quite how to respond. I remember I said something and he called in the general manager and he talked to the general manager for 5-10 minutes. He goes, okay, it's signed off, and ended the meeting. He approved it. And I went to my boss later. I'm like, what happened? Like, what am I missing here? Because that was a disaster of a meeting from my perspective. And he looked at me and he said, Paul, your analysis was brilliant, but your presentation lacked. I hadn't taken the time to really think through the presentation and make sure it was laid out in a way that would make sense to the CFO. I was so caught up in the weeds that I didn't focus on what I'll call the last mile of analytics, which is the presentation. And that's very common in finance. We don't spend enough time crafting the story.
Mm, That's very interesting. And do you think that somebody that might be sort of listening to us talk about that and you sharing that actually really interesting story, do you think that the thing that you could do to make that actionable would be to sort of budget time for the presentational layer to accept that there might be 6 hours of like analysis time in Excel to reach a point where you've got something that could influence the company, but you need to budget another hour or two for the presentational layer because it's too easy for a numbers person to allow that to fall behind?
Correct. Yeah, you have to budget in that time. And it's very hard. It's not easy. We as finance people are often overworked. And so we go in last minute. But if you could start forcing yourself, say, okay, I'm going to cut it here. I've got to the main point, and not dig deeper unless you really think there's a reason you need to, then you'll be able to carve out a little more time for that analysis and for thinking about the narrative. And hopefully, you know, especially if it's an important presentation, bouncing it off someone within your staff or your team, if you have somebody you can, so that you can ensure you have the best story, you know, possible before you go into the meeting.
Yeah. It so often is, can you end up with what is essentially a storyline that will resonate with your audience? And it's not easy for a finance person to think about audience, right? That sounds theatrical. But actually the process of how you run meetings and how sort of decisions are made in businesses often does involve a little bit of theater.
Exactly. One of the other kind of frameworks we teach when we get into data storytelling, my training partner and I, this is one Ron Montero created. He calls it ACE. We say ACE your storytelling. And the A is for audience, right? Focus on your audience. Then the C is for content. When I say content, I always like to say, think about what's in it for them. WIIFT, not what's in it for me. And then we end with execution, you know, body language, vocal inflection, all those things that matter beyond just what we're presenting.
Yeah, that is fascinating. ACE, yeah, I think a lot of people think about that. And you're quite right. Yeah, we don't think enough about the people skills, the human skills involved in how you transfer what you know, how you seek to influence others. And you're quite right. You know, even the tone of your voice or the way it's presented can have quite a big impact on somebody. It's a super, super interesting topic. Paul, I'm conscious we could talk about this stuff all day, by the way. I was really keen just to see if we could kind of wrap up the podcast on one last question from me, if that's okay.
Of course.
Yeah. So I'd say one of the characteristics that we always see, so we do about 70 events a year, most of them in London, but more and more over time, places like Amsterdam and Bristol and Manchester. And when we get people out and they sort of chat with their peer group, one of the things that we hear all the time is everybody's very time poor, and you can only really allow quite a small number of hours in any given month towards things that are, you know, learning and development. And so it's quite hard to pick like what might you focus on that month or that quarter as your kind of personal career development item. And if you had to make one recommendation for CFOs as to how they might improve how they get their FP&A delivered, you know, what would you steer people towards?
Yeah, I mean, I think it starts with, like you mentioned, finding ways that are not time consuming, or that you can do when you're doing something else, just so you can educate and improve yourself. So I think great ways are podcasts. You know, you have FP&A Tomorrow out there, FP&A Today, and others. I think, you know, following some people on LinkedIn that share a lot of best practices. So I think within that, it's really just spending some time to learn what others are doing. Like what you do is great, Guy, right? Having those monthly conversations where you can go talk to someone. So I think it starts with doing simple things. Then from there, I think that periodic, maybe it's one day a quarter, or maybe it's 4 hours a month, whatever it might be, is set aside some time that you can dig deeper into something, potentially take a course, or, you know, do a course online, or reading a book or whatever. But at the end of the day, if you're not investing in yourself, it's hard to grow and reach your potential. And so it's important that you do find a plan that works for you, for your training. You know, that's an area I'm always happy to talk to people about. I love training around FP&A, and I think it's something we can do better throughout the profession.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. That is super interesting. So it sounds like if you're really at a baseline and you think you want to make a dent in your FP&A capabilities, start off with these things that you can just snack on at lunchtime, be that something on LinkedIn, you know, following people like yourselves. Maybe when you're walking the dog, you're down the gym, have your FP&A podcast all lined up and ready to go. Start to absorb, maybe a little passively, but it's still going to prompt how you think about those things. And then as you really seek to double down on improving what you and your team could offer the business, you really need to be carving out some hours, 2, 3, 4 hours a month, and focusing on things that you're learning to improve how you perhaps, you know, present into the leadership team, or to improve focusing on the right metrics, or looking for more leading indicators rather than financial indicators. So it looks like a process of those two things, a little bit of just learn when you can, and then trying to carve out time to really cement that into changing your behaviors and really getting new things delivered.
Exactly. You need the combination of both. Find little ways that aren't overwhelming, but remember, you do need to carve out time, and you do need to, you know, invest in yourself beyond just being passive.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I think in a world where people are super busy, and certainly all the tech CFOs I know are very time poor, that's a very good approach. Paul, look, it's been really good to have you on the podcast. I mean, super fascinating. We covered so much in about 30 minutes. It was incredible, like a real whirlwind tour of all of the FP&A components that are highly relevant for people in tech startups and scale-ups. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Guy. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you today, and look forward to sharing this with your audience.
You were listening to CFO Insights, brought to you by Startup CFO. If you're a finance professional working in disruptive tech and would like to join our global network, visit our website, startupcfo.tech, to learn more. This podcast was a part of our CFO Insights series of discussions. If you want to become more involved in the Startup CFO group, then follow us on LinkedIn or apply to join the community. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.